Good morning. We are here at long last. There's always something that might happen on the way, but this is Wanderings today, and we're so happy to welcome Chuck Johnson here. This is Syl Stemmen.
And this is Sandy Washington.
And Chuck, you're sitting down. Why are you not running around?
I am, but I'm doing it up here.
Okay. No. Well, while we got you here, we're going to ask you a few questions and hopefully hear how you feel about Holly Creek. So where do you hail from?
I'm from Hammond, Indiana, which is just in the northwest corner of Indiana, bordering Chicago.
But how did you get to Denver?
I drove a U-Haul truck.
Along the the trail of...
Followed the Lewis and Clark Trail, yeah. So to speak. No, actually, back in 86, I got married. And then in 19, we saved our money in 1988. Well, actually, I shouldn't say it. In 1986, we moved out here, and then rented a house or an apartment, and then I saved our money and bought a house and moved about a block and a half away from here.
From here, from Holly Creek?
Correct.
What year was that?
1988.
So when did they start building this?
They built this, started around 2008, I think it was
prairie land.
Yes, there was nothing here. Kaiser was there, but that was about it. But prior to Kaiser going in, this was all vacant land right here on the corner.
Well, tell us about your family when you were in Indiana. Who was sitting around your table?
Well, I had three sisters, one brother, my mom and dad, family of seven. We all grew up back there in Indiana.
Well, you know what? You told us that there was something we could watch, a film that we could watch that would tell us what your life was like in those years.
Hammond, Indiana is portrayed in the Christmas Story. That pretty much gives you a really good example of my childhood. If you ever wanted to see what it was like growing up, you watch the Christmas Story. A lot of people have seen it. Some people may not have seen it, but that's the author of the book who wrote the story of the Christmas Story is actually from Hammond, Indiana. They call it Homan, Indiana, and Homan Avenue was the main thoroughfare going into downtown Hammond. And so rather than name the story, or, you know, the town Hammond, they changed it to Homan. They actually, the author grew up on Cleveland Street in Indiana. And so it depicts a childhood life of us kids growing up back then.
And we can get it on YouTube?
Yeah, you can watch it on TV, you can watch it on YouTube, Netflix, you'll get it anywhere. Around the holiday season, it's going to be out.
So in a word or two, how would you describe that life of those early days for you?
In a word or two? Cold, fun. It was pretty eventful.
A lot of kids, a lot of neighborhood kids.
Yeah, a lot of kids. Everyone knew everyone. Everyone's mom knew every kid in town. So if you got in trouble, it was definitely going to get to your mom. Life back then was that everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew everybody's business, and everybody knew to take care of.
It sounds like the kind of the good old days.
It is the good old days.
Play outside and play till it's dark. And
yeah, when the street lights come on, you go back inside.
Mm-hmm. And then, it's pretty nice. Yeah. Pretty nice.
There are good and bad spots of growing up in a small town.
Yes.
Well, I have a question to ask you about Holly Creek. Why did you come here?
Actually, to be totally honest with you, I have my own business, and my wife decided that she was going to retire, so I had to find something else to do in order to provide insurance for us. Holly Creek is about a block and a half away from here. Some people will remember Rick that used to work here. He's a neighbor that lived across the street from me. I spoke with him about it, and he said, yeah, they're looking for someone. So here I came.
Is he the one that played the guitar?
No. Rick was in maintenance. He was kind of a tall, husky guy. Had glasses.
I'm thinking of the wrong person. But you also said you came here to have fun.
Yeah.
Explain.
A lot of people have heard it, and those of you that haven't heard it, I didn't come here to work. I came here to have fun. That's the way I look at coming here. The fun part is, I don't know. Come here to do things and have fun, and the do things would have been changing the light bulbs in your apartment, cleaning out your toilet so that it flushed, fix your washing machine. That was just doing things. The other part's just come here and have fun. Socialize with all the residents, become friends with the residents. That's pretty much what I've done. I have over 300 and something friends here.
And that's well, you're doing a really good job in that department. Excellent
and
job.
And then, you know, it's just kind of watch over and see what needs to be done and make sure that everybody has a happy time and a fun time while they're here. And
how long have you been here?
Oh, a little over 4 years now.
4 years.
Yeah.
How many maintenance men do you have helping you?
Five maintenance guys right now. They do a really fantastic job. They have the same outlook that I have, and I try to emphasize that to them. You shouldn't be coming here to do work. You should be coming here to have fun and do things. And the do things and make everybody else happy.
Cool.
By doing that, you're fixing whatever needs to be fixed and helping out in any way that you need.
I'd like to ask those that are listening, have you ever seen one that was grumpy? We don't.
Yeah, I don't think so. And that's what makes... That's when I was in maintenance, that's what made maintenance fun, you know. Everybody came in, had a good time, and as long as you're doing that, you get along with everybody and one another, and then it's not really work. It's come here and socialize and do stuff while you're socializing. That's
well,
there's
got to be one that kind of gives a sense of direction.
Well, yeah.
I mean, some of the people that are hired don't know all of the parts of the job description. So what do you do about that?
So what I do about it is I teach them everything I know. My way of looking at it, if there's something that somebody doesn't know and they need to know it, I'll take them by the hand and show them. The more guys that know how to do what I know how to do, the less often I have to do it. So anything I can teach them limits the amount of times that I have to do it, and then I can go on and learn something else and then teach that. So that's kind of my philosophy here. I think all the guys down in the shop will understand or see that that's kind of what I do. If you need to know something, ask me. I'll share every bit of knowledge that I have. It's not going to do me any good to take it home with me. It's not going to do me any good to take it to my grave, so I'm going to teach
you
everything I can.
Well, how did you accumulate all the knowledge?
Ah, trial and error, most of it. I had a really... intelligent and knowledgeable father who taught me an awful lot of things growing up. As I mentioned to you before, one of the things about my father is I looked at him growing up as like he was God. He knew everything. If I had a problem, I had a guy to go to. He was always three steps ahead of me. He seemed to have the answer to everything and taught me by being three steps ahead how to do that, so how to foresee things that are coming, not just work on what you're working on now, but what goes after that. And that's kind of where I've gotten a lot of my knowledge, just watching him and then learning from him. I worked for him in his body shop. And
starting
as
at what
I mentioned,
age?
I was sanding and masking cars at the age of five in the garage that my brother, my dad, my uncle, and I
tell us
attached.
Again what you were doing to the cars.
I was sanding them and masking them off so that he could do the body work and the paint work to it. So I was running a body shop with the age, not running it, but working it at the age of five, if you will.
You saw everything that was going on. Did you ever get on one of those things that slide under the cars?
Yes, I've been under the creeper. That's called the creeper.
Creeper?
Yeah, been on there plenty of times. Under the cars plenty of times. I did body and paint work until I was about, well, until I moved out here, until I was about 28 years old, 29.
Oh, who is it that has cars in the maintenance set? Is it Julian that has cars, that does a lot of car work outside?
Yeah, Julian's doing a lot of little tinkering with, you know, painting and doing things like that and fixing his cars up and things. Yeah, he's doing that sort of thing, too.
Yeah, so yeah. I bet you have good times chatting with him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I give him advice and vice versa, but yeah. He's showing
well, can
me
you tell us
at.
More about your father? He had...
Oh, my father wasn't around when I was really young, very much, because he was working all the time. He had like three or four different jobs. Raising, you know, five kids in a household was back in the 50s and the 60s and 70s was pretty trying. So he worked quite a bit. He worked in as an operating engineer, but before that he was a mechanic on all the heavy-duty equipment, so he taught himself. While the guys were on break, he would get into the crane or he would get into the bulldozer and he would just run it, learn it. So he taught himself basically how to operate cranes and backhoes, bobcats, all these sort of heavy-duty equipment that he was a mechanic
on. And you mentioned
on.
One that was a record-making tow truck.
Yes, he built the... He and a couple other guys in the shop, when he was working in a mechanical shop for diesel trucks and trailers and things like that, they put together and built what was called the world's largest tow truck at the time, using that to drive over to derailed trains and pick up the train cars from one end, put it back on the track, then pick up the other end. It was an amphibious vehicle that they got from the military. They actually put smokestacks on the exhaust and on the intake of it and drove it into Wolf Lake, which was across the street, and submerged it underwater. All the electronics, everything was sealed tight. So they drove it through there. People used to go there and picnic and have fun and swim and fish, and all of a sudden all this tow truck comes driving through and in and out. So they had some fun in their
just
days.
Just get out of the
yeah.
way.
So my dad was very knowledgeable. He went to a technological school, and he learned a lot of things, electronics, blueprint reading, mechanical work, fabrication, all sorts of things. So a lot of what I have today I learned from him, and then took the knowledge of how to gain that knowledge and found it out on my own.
Well, you also started out at filling stations and
oh yeah.
you did
when
all
I
that.
Was a kid, I worked in the gas station, towed vehicles. We did this, you know, the normal...
This was as a teenager?
Yeah, we did the normal things, you know, 12, 13, 14. I was checking air in your tires, changing your oil,
yeah,
putting
was the
gasoline
day. Drivers
in there,
had it
washing
pretty nice.
Your windows, doing all the things that a full-service gas station used to do. So I started out doing all those things. We ended up, when I was 16, I was put in a tow truck. We towed the vehicles when the cars would crash. Our Shell station had to contract with the city of Hammond with the police department. So if you crashed your car or something like that and it needed to be towed, or you got in trouble or something like that and it needed to be towed, we were the guys that came and towed it for you. So we had a pretty good rapport, if you will, with the policemen and the police department. So
oh. You knew them pretty well.
Well, you were
telling
us.
Yes, I did a lot of things. Plowed snow. That's where I learned to plow snow, way back when I was 15 and 16, behind the plow. We had like 400 and something lots to do. And there were days when it was around the clock because it snowed a lot there. So, yeah, we would live in the snow plow for
it
a
did.
Few days and
that's
things.
That's a
so
snowy area.
That's how I know all about this snow plowing, and I did the same thing here. Before I moved out, before I started working at Holly Creek in the wintertime, that's what I did. My business was ever friend that had retail businesses, and I would plow snow for him. So,
well, now out here in Colorado, you have found hunting.
Hunting is my hobby, I guess you would
and
say.
I like the way you regard hunting as a way to feed the family.
Well, that's it.
Okay.
saved a ton of money by bringing an elk home. An elk, if harvested right, can feed a family, you know, two families for a year and a half, which is what we normally do. If I shot an animal, I was usually with my friend or friends, and they'd help me pack it out, and then they get a part of the animal. So that's how you would end up feeding more than one family with one animal. And then if they got one, I mean, just we there were plenty of us hunting, so we just shared it with the others. And so, but yes, I don't hunt for the antlers or for the horns or anything like that. Basically, to feed my family, and it's a good way to.
And you said it was a humane way.
Well, definitely humane, because they don't see it coming. It's not like rounding them up and putting them in a fenced-in area and then running them through, you know, the blocks or whatever, and then processing them that way. No, they don't know it's coming. It's quick. It's pain. I'm sure there's pain to it, but it's fast, and it's a more humane way.
And then you take care of it afterwards.
Yep, take every bit of it. Way, as I was, you were talking about the other day, would take the hide and everything out.
And
I'm a member of the Elks Club, so what I do is we bring the hide to a gentleman that's over there in Littleton, and they take that hide and they tan it, and they use that to make gloves for disabled veterans and people that need gloves that are in wheelchairs and stuff like that, to kind of protect their hands when they're moving around with their wheelchairs.
I'm really happy to hear that.
It's all used. We use the whole animal. So that's kind of a that's a life for a hunter for me.
Oh, I think that's fabulous.
And
tell us,
the elk have to be a certain size, don't they?
Oh yeah. When you're hunting, there's requirements. You can't just use, you know, shoot any animal or anything. Everything, you have to have a license, and there's requirements. You just can't take the small ones or something like that, you know.
We had elk and deer all around our home. Up in Evergreen, but now what is the license restricting as far as distance? I know you can't take advantage of any of those animals, but what are the limits, or where does it begin, the hunting area?
Well, there are hunting areas all over the state of Colorado. They call them, you know, they're numbered.
They're all designated.
Areas, for example, I would hunt an area 15, which would give you an idea. Be from the Gore Mountain area across to Yampa Valley. It's just an area, certain areas of the state that you're able to hunt with, that you draw a tag for that area.
Okay.
There's different seasons. There's a archery season, muzzle loading season, then becomes a rifle season. So there's several seasons to harvest elk and deer. And you apply for those tags and those licenses, and you specifically hunt in those areas.
Okay. Now, after, I think it was your family went to a camp near Estes Park, and you went to pick them up, and on the way home you asked, or they asked, said they were hungry, and you stopped at a restaurant. Can you tell the rest of that story?
Yeah, well, my adoptive son, Carl, well, we send all the kids. I have my biological son, Nicholas, then I have two other kids, Cheyenne and Carl, that we adopted. They all went to the youth group, church youth group camp for a week up near Estes Park. And I believe it was a YMCA facility there. But they spent the week there, and then we picked them up on Saturday to bring them home. And on the way back home, driving through Estes Park, they got hungry, so we decided to stop into one of the hotel restaurants there in town. While sitting there deciding what we're going to eat, Carl asked me a question. He said, "Hey, Chuck, can I have the elk?" And I looked at the elk on the menu, and I looked at the price of it, and then I looked at Carl, and I said, "Carl, how much does the elk cost?" And he said, $45. I said, $45? He said, "For 4 ounces, though." I'm like, "Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Carl. When you get home, each time you have a piece of that meat that's coming out of the freezer, I want you to think about that." And then I pointed at each one of us at the table. If you have one, and Cheyenne has one, and Nicholas has one, and Mom has one, and I have one, at $45 each time, how much does that cost? Maybe you ought to think about having something else on the menu. You could have a 4-ounce steak any day
when
of
you
the
go
week.
Home.
Try something different, okay?
So. Well, you've talked about Nicholas quite a bit. I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, Nicholas and I are like, it's almost growing up, he was a twin to me when I was growing up. So there's no doubt he's my son. But he's a musician now. He went to college, got his own scholarship and everything else, paid his way to go through college. He became a, he's a cellist, so he has his music performance degree and with his cello, and then also he's got a music teaching degree. So he teaches orchestral music up in the Mapleton School District, which is up near Thornton, north side of Denver. A lot of those kids there are kind of, let's just say that their life isn't as easy as somebody else's. So they all need some help in some fashion. Something he always wanted to do was be helpful to other people, and specifically students when he became a musician and a music teacher. He thought about going to the inner city of Chicago. I talked him out of that. Oh. And so Mapleton seemed to work out for him because those kids needed a lot of help and stuff like that. So he's kind of doing what his dream was, and that's it. He also performs with the Longmont Symphony Orchestra with his cello. And he's played with the Colorado Symphony Orchestra, he's played in many different places.
Making
hopefully
a name
one
for
day
himself.
We'll have him over here playing. Matter of fact, a week ago when we were hiking, we were discussing him coming here and performing for people.
That would be a treat for all of us.
Yeah.
I hope that can work out.
Yeah.
Music is so important in one's life, I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely is. He's always had music in his room. When he grew up, he came home as a baby, I'd had orchestral music in his room. It was always playing there. And then sometimes we switch it over to my stuff, but for the most time when he was small, that was it. And that makes a big difference in how kids grow up.
Well, I'm going to change the subject for a quick minute and tell about something that's at the concierge desk that I never knew about. And I don't know how many people do know about it, but one day I saw a little trail of tiny little black ants in a corner of our apartment. And I thought, what are we going to do about that? Well, I asked you. And this is the advice you gave.
Yeah, well, if you have ants or you have a bug or something like that, you put in a work order like you would anything else, and then maintenance will come there, and they will spray. They have little ant traps that they put down, and if they can spray, they'll spray. But then there's the bug book. There is a book behind the concierge desk that maybe some people aren't aware of, but when you have those, you make sure you get that put into the bug book, and every month when the fellow that comes here to take care of the mouse traps and things like that around the community, he also goes to the bug book and he finds out who's had issues and who's had problems in their apartment, and then he comes and then professionally comes in there and takes a look at the situation. Sprays whatever or does whatever he thinks should happen. So if you're unaware of it, now you're aware of it. There's the bug book. And if you had bugs, you put in the work order, we come and address the issue, but then we make sure that he follows up with it by going to the bug book at the each month.
Well, we're not entered into the bug book as yet. It was only 2 days and they disappeared. I guess we didn't have anything they wanted.
Yeah, well, there you go.
that was good. You have another side business.
I have a business that I always had since 2000. I started that. It's curbscaping. It's the decorative concrete edging that you see showing up in people's yards and so forth like that, as opposed to putting in steel edging or wooden edging or bricks and things like that. It's actually it's a machine that I use to extrude the concrete. We mix it up at a little trailer at the street with the wheelbarrow, bring it over, put it into the machine, and the machine kind of packs it and pushes it out the front, kind of like squeezing toothpaste out of a tube.
And so in what way is it decorative?
Pardon me?
In what way is it decorative? Just by the shape of the
edge?
Well,
the shape of it is one, but it can be colored, and we can stamp and texture it, just like they stamp and texture your patios and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Stamp and texture it and give it a color and that sort of thing.
So when do you take care of that business?
I do that part-time, weekends, after I get out of work in the afternoons. Not as much as I used to. I ended up spending more time doing this job than... when I was my 8 to 5-er,
it seems like you've been working
a lot more,
life.
Like 10 and 12 hour days. So it's far and in few between. So I have to work it into a schedule, mostly on the weekends or something like that.
What do you do for fun?
What
besides
do I do
the
for fun
being here in Holly Creek?
Well, I'm a member of the Elks Club, so I go to the Elks Club. That's kind of fun. Participate in some of the things that take place there, and I also. You know, hunting is fun for me, and spending time with my son, Nicholas, for example, last weekend, over the Labor Day weekend. We did a hike. We were going to do a 14er, but it didn't turn into a 14er. I wish it would have, because it was a straight up climbing rocks and so forth in Boulder, but we got through it.
You wish
it
were?
I got through it.
And,
yeah, so I do a lot of things with my son. Nicholas.
And, he lives in Denver?
Yeah, he lives in North Denver, or downtown Denver, I should say, yeah.
So it's easy to get in touch with him.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
he's close.
That's great.
He's close.
Well, I hope he does come to play the cello here.
Yeah, that's my hope as well. We're going to set something up, see
let
how that
know.
Works out, so he can play here. Yeah.
Well, I like that you talked about your thinking of your men in maintenance as full-grown men can make decisions for themselves, and you treat them.
Yeah, they don't need anybody to take them by the hand. They're old enough to know what to do, and they're familiar with the facility, and those that aren't learn it as time goes on.
As you go.
Any questions they have, they can always come to me. It's not like I'm always going to have the answer, but we're going to solve whatever it is. But
well,
for the most part, they don't need leadership. They didn't get to where they're at this age with having somebody take them by the hand everywhere. They're on their own now.
You stated at the beginning you came here to have fun.
That's it.
So one last question. Mm-hmm. Has it been fun talking on the radio?
Actually, it has been fun. I've avoided this for quite a few years. but no, it's fun. It's fun talking with you girls and with Jim here. It's fun.
Well, thank you, Chuck. Thank you for saying yes to the invitation, and it's always good to see you around.
You're welcome. We got it done, and I won't have to do it again.
And that's Wanderings
for
today.
Thanks
to you always. So long.